You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
On November 12th, catch Red Hook Summer, the latest film from director Spike Lee. And on November 13th, don't miss Savages, the new film from Oliver Stone starring Taylor Kitsch, Blake Lively, and Benicio del Toro, in an unrated cut that wasn't available in theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on cable. The Art House is now in your house.
This podcast is also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/SVU.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Coming up on this week's show, Matt and I play some ironic softball, hang out, in air quotes, at a local bar until we almost get sarcastically beaten up, and then talk about the new film, The Comedy, all the while having no idea whether the other person is being serious or not.
Before we do that, we'll bring you Cue Shots, our look at some of the current offerings on various streaming and VOD sites, all centered around a common theme. And inspired by The Comedy, which is set around the Brooklyn neighborhood of Williamsburg, and by the fact that we're recording this in a city still in recovery from Hurricane Sandy, a storm we were both lucky enough to get through unscathed, we are going to talk about films set in New York.
But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight one title that's new on VOD and give you a rundown of other notable films new on demand on cable. Matt, what's our first pick this week?
Our first pick is a film I think I briefly mentioned on our last show. It's called Natural Selection from the year 2011, directed by Robbie Pickerling and starring Rachel Harris and Matt O'Leary. Rachel Harris, you would recognize her probably best as Ed Helms' evil fiance from The Hangover. She did a lot of those I Love the 70s TV shows, I Love the 80s, I Love the 90s.
Funny. She's a really funny lady.
She's very funny, yeah. She's also the mom in the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series, which, Allison, I know
That's
you're a
right.
huge fan of.
Huge fan.
Actually, those movies aren't that bad. But anyway, this movie gives her kind of a chance to show that beyond being just a really funny comedian, she's a pretty talented actress. She's very much cast against type here as a housewife in a fundamental Christian community in Texas. And because she had lost the ability to have children years before, her husband has refused to have sex with her for years because sex is only for procreation. So if there's no chance of that, there's no sex. So she's having this very unfulfilled, frustrated life, not realizing that meanwhile her husband is going to the sperm bank regularly to...
It's a loophole.
Yes, exactly. He's found a loophole that does not apply to her. So that's the essential beginning of the film. I don't really want to spoil what happens next because I think part of what makes the movie so wonderful is it's very surprising the places that this woman's journey goes to. But let's just say that one of the trips to the sperm bank by her husband is quite eventful, and that creates a change of life for Linda, that's Rachel Harris's character, in a few ways.
What do you mean a few days late? If you're in some kind of a situation where you can't tell me, just give me a signal.
Really? I'm okay.
Was that a signal?
Oh, you ever quit?
No, lady.
Not a chance.
You've never been drunk before?
Yes!
She is committing crimes. It's like the Patty Hearst syndrome.
The movie won the Audience Award and along with several jury prizes at the 2011 South by Southwest Film Festival. I actually saw it at Ebert Fest a few months after that, Roger Ebert's film festival in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. And Rachel Harris and Robbie Pickerling were there. They were very nice. I got to meet them. I got to talk with them and hang out with them. And I think it's a really, really nice, very well-made independent film. Great portrait, very nice performance by Rachel Harris. Funny, touching, it kind of like what you like from an independent movie. You know, it's a character study, but it's got a lot of humor, a lot of heart. Clearly would never have been made by any studio because it goes to some very unusual places and takes some interesting chances. It's just a really smart movie. I recommend it. It's called Natural Selection. It's going to be available on VOD starting on November 13th. And Allison, do we have a few other VOD picks?
We do. Also on VOD this month is I Wish from the great Japanese director Hirokazu Kore-eda, who has made Still Walking, Nobody Knows, and Afterlife. And this is a film about two young brothers who are living in different cities after their parents got divorced. One has gone to live with their father, who's a musician. The other has gone to live with their mother, who has moved home. And they're building a new bullet train between the regions where the brothers live. And one of them has heard in school through kind of like child urban legend that if you're there the first time that the bullet trains pass each other, that the energy is such that you can make a wish and it'll come true. So it sounds unbearably schmaltzy. It's actually very sweet, I think, because Kore-eda is one of the greatest directors of child actors I can think of. He's so good at allowing them to seem like children and to kind of really play like children. And, you know, the brothers make plans to meet, but it's also about how they kind of slowly adjust to their new surroundings and make friends at school. And it's a pretty lovely film. It's not, I think, maybe as great as my favorite of his films, which is Still Walking, but it's definitely one that's worth a look. And that is on demand on November 6th. On demand November 13th is The Queen of Versailles, which is a documentary that's been talked about a lot.
I'm looking forward to seeing this one. Have you caught it yet?
I have.
Oh, okay.
It's very interesting.
Oh, all right, good. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's about David Siegel, who is he's a timeshare king, and his wife, a former beauty queen, and their 8 children. As they prepare to move into the house that they're building in Florida, one that, if it were ever finished, would be the largest single-family house in America. It's this, like, 30-bedroom, 10-kitchen monstrosity that's modeled partially after Versailles.
Nice.
But also after
the title.
Yeah, also after the Paris Hotel in Vegas.
Well, I mean, nothing's gone wrong with the housing market recently, so it all must have turned out really well for them.
Really, really well. I think, actually, the fact that the film was started before the 2008 economic crash and then takes in the turn of fortunes for the family that happens after that, makes it a much better film because it starts off almost inviting you to just judge these people who have some really garish taste. You know, you first look around their house and there is some amazing, including like commissioned historical style portraits on the wall and things like that. But it becomes a really smart and kind of poignant look at the American dream as this almost illness, you know, in terms of like the need for like acquisition and building yourself up from you know, humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. It becomes a really interesting look at what it means to be happy. And it's a very interesting doc, and it is available on demand on November 13th.
Allison, we're very happy to have Audible back as a sponsor of SVU this week. And Audible.com is the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. And for our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. And Allison, you're going to recommend something to them right now, aren't you?
I am. It's actually a book that I mentioned on our last podcast that's been on my mind ever since we talked about video games and the idea of video games as an art that's just starting to kind of come into its own mm-hmm. as a serious medium, you know, one that can be discussed critically. And I think that it's worth a read or listen in this case if you are interested in video games or in just the idea of criticism of a new medium. It's Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter. It is written by Tom Bissell and narrated by the author. And it is a collection of essays that deal with different games as well as the very idea of when do you start treating a medium like art as something capable of art. And he actually deals a bit with the idea of like loving games and the capacity for them, while also acknowledging that the dialogue is not there yet, acknowledging that oftentimes he feels a little embarrassed about getting deeply involved in a game about elves or something that's just not quite there, especially in terms of writing. But he manages to explore gameplay and the art of game making, and it deals with some indie games as well in a way that I think is very smart. So if you are a fan of video games, or if you are just curious about video games and kind of want an approach that's not just jumping in. Exactly. Or just, you know, jumping in if you don't have a console yet, I think that this provides a very smart way to look at gaming.
And what's the title one more time?
It's Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter.
Okay. And for a free audiobook of your choice, including Extra Lives, go to audiblepodcast.com/SVU. That's audiblepodcast.com/SVU.
Now, we wanted to talk about films set in New York, partially because the comedy is set in New York and in a kind of a relatively unexplored area of New York cinematically, but also because we have just come through a kind of epic New York event. And
Timing seemed fortuitous.
Yeah, we're actually recording this in my apartment. We usually don't do that. We usually record in Matt's apartment.
You mean a high-tech, top-notch, state-of-the-art studio.
Right.
Which we couldn't get to.
We couldn't get to. So, in fact, now we are making do underneath a tent, basically.
We made a tent to muffle the sound and try to give you as best an approximation of the sound quality that we usually give you.
Yes.
Hopefully it's working. It seems to be working so far.
If you've ever wondered what it's like when we record the podcast, just imagine two adults underneath a sheet.
Held up by a standing desk?
Yes, held up by a standing desk because, you know, health first.
The glamorous life of podcasters,
it's
folks.
It's amazing.
This is what it is. Yeah. But yeah, so it seemed like an appropriate subject given this week. Luckily, both of us were, you know, we're not complaining. We're okay, and our houses are okay, and everyone is okay. But it was quite an experience.
It was very Day After Tomorrow-esque.
Yes. Roland Emmerich called and demanded some royalties, I think. Did you lose power at any point?
I didn't. I was very lucky.
We were both very lucky. We didn't even lose power. Yeah, me neither.
It was one of the strange things that Manhattan lost power, you know, that you often think that New York, like that Manhattan of all places, is like one of the most central, you know,
right,
urban places in the world. And many friends, and I'm sure you have friends as well, that are in the area that were without power for days.
Yep.
And, you know, not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
Very, not great.
Well, it's a good time then to celebrate New York with some New York movies. There are so many. I mean, it's a tough category to narrow down. It's funny. I was walking with my wife last night, and I just said, well, what comes to your mind when I say the phrase New York movies? What do you think of? And all the movies she thought of were romantic comedies, which I thought was pretty interesting. And these are and good ones.
Yeah.
Sleepless in Seattle.
Right.
When Harry Met Sally. You've Got Mail. You know, like that to her, she's like, when I picture New York on screen, I picture it snowing lightly and people being in love. I thought that was really interesting because that definitely is a strain. But there are, you know, I've come up with a list of somewhat more darker films, you know, like my on-screen New York is very different. But it's funny how you could have two totally different images that come to your mind when you say like New York on screen, or three or four or five. There are so many different ones, and there's some of the greatest movies ever made that are good New York movies. Is there anything that defines your picks, or did you just go for a range of options?
I just went for a range of options, and I was trying to keep in mind maybe aspects of New York that I didn't immediately associate, that weren't the first things that came to mind for me when I think of them, you know, so I didn't do any Woody Allen.
Martin Scorsese, he's out.
I didn't do Martin Scorsese. I did do one pick from a filmmaker who is a pretty associated with being a New York filmmaker, but
okay.
I did try and kind of go against, away from the usual picks. And
right.
As you said, there are so many. I mean, I think that, you know, one of my favorite New York movies, I always love The Royal Tenenbaums because it seemed to me to be a movie made by someone who had maybe never been to New York, but had always read like New Yorkers and kind of come up with a fantasy New York based on that. And I loved that idea. Or, you know, some other ones that I don't have as picks, but like Two Lovers, and it's showing Brighton Beach, which is like such a distinctive and very different part
that
of
you
New
don't
York.
See on screen too much. Yeah.
Yeah. Or the movie Frownland, which unfortunately was not available streaming, but like has this really great nightmarish depiction of New York that is really like nothing else I've seen, even in the dark kind of aspects of it. Saving Face, which is set in Flushing, you know, or Girls, actually, the TV show Girls from Lena Dunham is set in the neighborhood we are recording this in right now, in Greenpoint.
Like, I love the episode where they make a podcast under a tent. I thought that was a really profound
one. I really
line.
Related to it, actually.
For some reason, it touched me in a very deep place.
Just, it was amazing.
Yeah. Before we get to our picks, which I kind of did the same thing, it's like, you don't need me to tell you that Manhattan is a great movie. I tried to pick some less famous ones. We should mention, though, that quite a few of them are on Netflix. I have a list of the movies I'm not going to recommend that are on Netflix right now that are a little more famous. So if you haven't seen them, you can catch up with them, including Manhattan, Woody Allen's Manhattan, and Woody Allen's Broadway Danny Rose and Another Woman. Also, Bringing Out the Dead, Bad Lieutenant from Abel Ferrara. Death Wish, the classic Charles Bronson vigilante movie, Death Wish, which if you've never seen, another interesting New York movie. Midnight Cowboy, another classic.
Classic.
Absolute classic if you've never seen that. I mean, that is maybe the definitive late 60s New York right there. Serpico, classic cop movie with Al Pacino, another New York one. And another cop movie, The Taking of Pelham 123, the original. The original, because the remake never happened, Allison. You hear me? It never happened.
What remake?
Exactly.
I don't even know.
Exactly. So all of those are available on Netflix, but we've got six more picks for you that we're going to talk about in a little more depth. Allison, do you want to start with your first pick?
Yeah, sure. I was inspired to make this first pick by the comedy, because this is also set in the same area. It's Mutual Appreciation, the 2005 film from director Andrew Bujalski. It's available for rent on iTunes and Amazon. And I think that it makes an interesting pairing with the comedy in that if the comedy is about the kind of ironic, detached side of like Brooklyn hipsterdom, then the Mutual Appreciation is about people who are almost cripplingly nice. They are so kind of soft-spoken and afraid to say no that a lot of the situations and the comedy in Mutual Appreciation comes from their unwillingness to get into any kind of conflict, even very minor. This is a film that is probably one of the highlights of the mumblecore movement, along with Aaron Katz's Quiet City, which is also set in Brooklyn. It stars Justin Rice of the band Bishop Allen as Alan, who has just moved to New York and is crashing with his friend Lawrence, who's played by the director, Bujalski, and Lawrence's girlfriend Ellie, played by Rachel Cliff, who Alan starts finding himself drifting toward despite knowing better.
Do you plan on being a rock star for the duration? Like, is this the rest of your life?
Yes, yes, I would be a rock star for the duration. For the next 6 months while I'm still alive.
People flirt. It's not a big deal.
It's a free country.
But it is also just a portrait of post-20-something life, and in a very particular to New York as a landing place for people after college who have great aspirations, but very, you know, friends futon or kind of living arrangements, you know. And I think that it is very generous to these characters while also making it clear how sometimes a little ridiculous they are, and it sets up a lot of great scenarios, including one in which Alan arrives at a party in which he turns out to be the only guest, or in which they, you know, just sit around talking. It is a talkie movie, but I think in a very smart and painfully, at least for me, like painfully relatable way. So that's Mutual Appreciation. It's available for streaming on iTunes and Amazon.
Did you check to see if Quiet City is available?
It's not available, unfortunately. Mm. But if you have a DVD subscription from Netflix, I think it's available that way and is worth a look.
That is a great New York movie. That I like that great. Even better than Mutual Appreciation. Okay. It's funny that your first pick, you said, was sort of inspired by the comedy, because mine was too, even though mine is a 35-year-old movie. I just thought this would make a really nice double feature with the comedy because their protagonists strike me as very similar people. The name of the movie is The Landlord from 1970. It's available on Netflix. It's the directorial debut of Hal Ashby, who you may know as the director of Harold and Maude and Shampoo. He went on to make a lot of great movies. This is his first film, and Beau Bridges is the main character. He's the son, one of the sons of this very wealthy white family. He decides to buy a place of his own by becoming the landlord of a tenement in one of the worst neighborhoods in all of New York City, Park Slope. And Allison is chuckling now because that's where I live, near Park Slope now. That is one of the nicest, and let's just say it, it's one of the whitest neighborhoods in all of the five boroughs.
Incredibly bougie, yes.
Yes, exactly. And when this movie was set and took place, it was still, you know, it had not been gentrified. And the place he buys, the tenants are not too happy to see their new white landlord. And it's a pretty fascinating juxtaposition.
Hold it right there, honky.
Who's that?
Now turn around and march your buns back out that door before I shoot them out from under you.
Are you crazy? Why are you pointing that at me?
Because my horoscope told me that evil was coming to my door today. And Marge, here it is. So get moving, or else you ain't gonna have no hips to lean on. You dig?
No, lady, I own this house. I'm the new landlord.
And I'm a rented. Move it! And if you're a landlord, how come you ain't got no door keys?
No, I have door keys.
You know, you look like a rapist to me. You got funny eyes.
That's ridiculous.
If you figure on carrying out a sexual attack on me, you better learn the karate boogaloo, because we're going to tangle ass right here in this hall.
I am the new landlord.
I think the nutshell image is this. The beginning of the movie is very nice. The credits has this really wonderful back and forth juxtapositions between Park Slope as it was then, which is all these old brownstones, and everything is very earthy and brown and very dark colors. Even the sky, they filmed it on a rainy day just to really complete the picture. And that is intercut with Beau Bridges' character, whose name is Elgar Enders. And he is talking very naively about his ambitions and his dreams. He's wearing all white. He's filmed against an all-white backdrop, and his conversations are cross-cut with two white guys also dressed in white playing on a racquetball court, which is also all white. So you have a very, very obvious but powerful juxtaposition there. And during these back and forths, one of the shots of Park Slope is of this barbershop, this African-American barbershop, in this very distinctive building, which I recognized. It is now a yoga studio.
Of course.
And I thought that, in a nutshell, you couldn't get any better than that. But anyway, I think I mentioned Beau Bridges' character has these very sort of idealistic and very naive views of what's going to happen when he buys this place, that everyone's going to pay him money. And then eventually he'll be able to kick everyone out, actually, to turn it into condos, that he'll be able to live there and have this very luxurious place. And what I love about the movie is that it really kind of takes his ideas and really puts them up against some harsh realities, even though it's a comedy. You know, he has all these high-minded ideas, and he thinks of himself as this like very liberal guy. He comes from a very conservative family, and he thinks he's, you know, a real freedom fighter. But once he actually moves into the neighborhood, his ideals are really put to the test in a way that's very interesting and very surprising. So it's a really fun movie. It's a smart movie. It tackles ideas of gentrification and race, which are so huge in New York, but not really discussed all that often, in a very interesting way. It is available on Netflix. I really recommend it. And we can talk later, when we talk about the comedy, how it kind of dovetails really nicely with the character there and his quote-unquote dilemma. So that's The Landlord, and it's available on Netflix.
I haven't seen that, and I really am looking forward to it. It sounds great.
It's a pretty interesting movie.
Yeah, my next film is also set, actually, around that same neighborhood in a later era. It is Smoke, the 1995 film directed by Wayne Wang and the novelist Paul Auster, who kind of was making his first venture into film with this. He wrote the screenplay as well. And it is streaming on Netflix and Hulu Plus. This film stars Harvey Keitel's Augie, the owner of a small Brooklyn tobacco shop in 1990. It's on, I think, 3rd Street and 7th Avenue is the address that he gives. And this is a film that's very loose, both in spirit and in its form. It's told in kind of chapters, basically, because it's about different characters in the neighborhood who pass through the tobacco shop and just through the lives of the different characters who kind of come and go. So you have Jared Harris, Forest Whitaker, Stockard Channing, Herod Perrineau, Ashley Judd, Giancarlo Esposito, as just a few of the characters. William Hurt as a novelist who hasn't written since he lost his wife, and who seems like a possible stand-in in some ways for Paul Auster. But it's a film that you kind of demands that you get on its wavelength, and it's a very comfortable one. It's a film that really just enjoys the idea of people hanging out and talking.
Listen carefully. About 25 years ago, there was a young man who went skiing alone in the Alps. There was an avalanche. The snow swallowed him up, and his body was never recovered.
The end.
No. But the end. The beginning.
Paul Auster has said that he kind of wanted to draw comparisons to small talk and how people use it as a smokescreen to obscure kind of like larger dramas. But I think the film actually manages to blend the two in together very nicely and have some beyond just like an extreme fondness for Brooklyn and for the idea of a neighborhood as a kind of vivid, lively thing as a community. It also just has an enjoyment for people hanging out and talking, including the guys who bet at the OTB, something that doesn't exist anymore in New York.
No, just recently went away.
Yeah, but that, who kind of look over the racing guides and talk, and or even just the very idea of smoking as like a central aspect of these characters' lives.
That's true.
You know, and like something that they all enjoy and talk about. So it's interesting that this is a film made in the mid-90s, set in the early 90s, and already seems very far away, just in terms of culture. So it's I think a really enjoyable film and a very unhurried one, but one that takes great pleasure in dialogue. So that is Smoke. It's available for streaming on Netflix and Hulu Plus.
Okay, my next pick, like my first pick, is from the early 1970s. I guess I find that period really interesting because, you know, I've lived here now, although I grew up in New Jersey and I, did spend time in New York as a kid. I've lived here for just about 10 years now. And the New York City of some of these 70s movies just seems so unrecognizable.
Crazily different.
Right, because I recognize the places, like in The Landlord. You recognize the places, but the attitude and the atmosphere seems so different. And, a movie like Taxi Driver that I love so much, I don't think we even mentioned earlier because I don't think it's available it's not on Netflix anyway. You might be able to rent it. It's like hard to recognize the place as the same place you live, which I find fascinating. So that's sort of where this movie is also at, a little bit different. It could also count as extra credit for Film Spotting Original Recipe's current marathon, which is about blaxploitation. A lot of blaxploitation movies, understandably, set in New York City, as is this one, which isn't quite a blaxploitation film. It kind of more gets grouped into it because of what it's about and where it's set. It's a little bit different in terms of the tone, the style, and sort of what it's about than, say, a movie like Shaft, which I still love. I love Shaft, but it's somewhat different. It's called 110th Street, directed by Barry Scheer, and it's from 1972, and I always say that this movie reminds me of sort of The Wire before The Wire. It's a look at a crime from all angles. The beginning of the movie is this heist where these guys dressed as policemen rob a drug deal where basically the Italian mob and the Harlem mob, these African-American gangsters who work for them, are like splitting up money. They're going through the week's receipts and they're robbed. And then the rest of the movie is about the mob trying to find these guys and get revenge and the cops trying to solve the crime. So you get to see what life is like for all these different people, and the movie kind of draws connections between the people as sort of cogs in a machine, the same way that The Wire did so many years later in Baltimore, where it compared the cops with the drug dealers there. So, for example, the main cop is played by Anthony Quinn, and he's like a 50-year-old guy, and he's being slowly pushed out of the force because he's old and his attitudes are kind of out of touch. And his opposite number in the Italian mob is this guy who's essentially like a glorified bag man, and he's about the same age, a little bit younger, but he's never gotten to rise up in the mob, and that's a cause of frustration for him because he's never going to get anywhere at this rate. So you have these sort of similar characters in similar positions in their jobs. It's just that one happens to uphold the law and one breaks it.
Politicians feel that this other guy here should carry the ball.
Who?
Him, that dingy, the black guy.
Why, because he's black?
Because he's black, yeah.
Look, Jack, here in Harlem, he's going to get the same flag I do. He's still a cop.
That's so? What the hell do you care?
Look, is he going to stop a race right because he's black? Where was he last year? I stopped it myself. Just me, Jack. Just me.
Just politics, Frank. It doesn't have anything at all in it.
Scoop politics! Look, I'm not going to listen to any of this stuff about these guys.
You just got to get that through your head, Frank. It's his baby. Get that through your head.
In terms of it being a great New York movie, it was shot all over New York, particularly in Harlem. There are some amazing locations in Harlem, specifically in the end of the film, which is this big chase scene on the street and on the rooftops in Harlem. And you see these lots that are they look like – they don't even look abandoned. They look like bombs went off in them. They're like piles of bricks. They're unbelievable. And it is really incredible to see the way New York looked in 1972 in this movie. It's really great. It's a great crime movie. It's a really smart New York movie, a cop thriller, but also a sensitive one too, in that it really considers why people do what they do, why somebody would rob mobsters, the most idiotic thing you could ever do. I don't know if I'm pretty sure I haven't recommended it on SVU before, but I've talked about it before. It's one of my favorite movies. It's Across 110th Street. It's available on Netflix.
All right, and my last pick is another crime movie, though it's one that's set downtown. It's Inside Man, the 2006 film from director Spike Lee, who is one of the major New York directors.
Definitely.
It is streaming on Amazon. You know, Lee's 25th Hour and Inside Man are together, I think, the finest films about 9/11 that I can think of. You know, 25th Hour was made in 2002. In it, 9/11 is this kind of raw wound. But Inside Man is this really fond love letter to a healing New York. And it's one that's in direct conversation with Dog Day Afternoon. You know, it's about a bank heist and a crowd that gathers outside. But in this case, it's one that's, you know, set downtown on, I think, 20 Exchange Place by Wall Street is where it was filmed. And it is about New York in all of its kind of messy, diverse, and unified glory. You know, I think you've got Denzel Washington as Detective Keith Frazier, Chiwetel Ejiofor as his second in command, and they are going up against Clive Owen, who with his very organized team have come up with this plan to rob the bank that does not end in quite the same way as Dog Day Afternoon does. But I think that the great touches about this movie are just the way it's kind of pauses to just enjoy the characters and the kind of the people in the bank and outside of the bank, because of the way the crime, the heist works. There are a lot of interviews that they have to do with people who are inside the bank, and they're just funny, and they often break through to kind of have these moments of connection. You know, Waris Ahluwalia complains about the harassment he gets as a Sikh man in a turban. An elderly woman who they kind of are very, like, they treat very gently.
Where's my turban? I'm not talking to anybody without a turban. It's part of my religion, to cover my head in respect to God. I'm a Sikh.
Okay, we'll find your turban.
Not an Arab, by the way, like your cops called me outside.
I don't think you heard that. I mean, there was a lot going on. You were probably disoriented. I didn't hear that.
I heard what I heard. I'll give you all the information you want. I don't need this. I need my turban. It's part of my religion.
We'll get you your turban.
We'll find it for you. No, not get me. I want my turban now.
You just got to start thinking about the people inside the bank now. It's a dangerous situation. You got to start telling us about what's going on inside the bank. We can talk about this later. We'll get an officer, come down. You can write a formal complaint. But for now, we got to deal with this situation.
First you beat me, and now you want my help.
You need to start thinking about your coworkers.
Just the extreme fondness this film has for New York and New Yorkers is something that I find really moving. You know, it is a heist movie. It is a crime. It's a crime movie, but it's one that is about community and that is about community kind of slowly coming together. You've got Jodie Foster as this power broker, and her whole storyline with Christopher Plummer is basically about having this sense of, like, bad people will eventually get punished no matter how powerful they are, which I think is a weirdly
kind
lovely
of comforting
thing.
Yeah. thing at that point. Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot about this movie that is comforting and that is really warm. And, you know, especially for Spike Lee, who is somewhat, it doesn't go gently on people, but I think it is one of his kind of sunniest movies in a weird way because of that sense of coming together. So that's Inside Man, and it is streaming on Amazon.
That's a very good pick. My last pick is also a crime film. Wouldn't shock me if my pick was a inspiration on your pick by Spike Lee, just knowing its approach and just feeling like the way I'm going to describe it kind of sounds a little similar to the way you described Inside Man. It's called The Naked City from 1948, directed by Jules Dassin, and that's available on Hulu Plus. It's a Criterion film. The movie was produced and narrated by a gentleman by the name of Mark Hellinger, who was a former newspaper columnist. So the movie kind of feels almost like an adaptation of a whole bunch of newspaper columns. There's a main story, which is a crime story about a murder mystery and the cops trying to solve it. But there's all these brief vignettes where we meet all the people in the naked city. And the title, which eventually went on to inspire a TV show, the famous line, which is how the movie is remembered, is there's 8 million stories in the naked city, and this was one of them. And that's what it is. I mean, tellingly, there aren't really any movie stars in this film. This one doesn't have a Denzel Washington. The main character is a cop played by Barry Fitzgerald, who is this middle-aged, short, Irish actor. The star of the movie is New York City. I mean, that's how I think it was designed, and I think that's what comes across. Hellinger explains in the opening narration that the movie was not made in a studio. It was made on location in New York City, and it really shows. The cops work at the 10th Precinct in Chelsea, and if you go on Google right now and you type in 10th Precinct and you go to Google Maps and you look at Street View, it looks identical to the 10th Precinct that was in the movie in 1948. It looks exactly the same. They go past movie theaters with movies on the marquee. You can look up the movies they played in New York in 1947, you know, when they shot the movie. The big chase at the climax takes place through the Lower East Side, where I used to live. It took place a block from my house, and you can watch, you can recognize locations. They go into the Essex Street Market, which is still there. I showed my wife, she knew exactly where it was without me telling her. I said, "What's that?" She said, "It's the Essex Street Market. The doors haven't changed in more than 60 years.
It's 1 o'clock in the morning again, and this is the city, and these are the lights that a child born to the name of Batory hungered for. Her passion has been played out now. Her name, her face, her history were worth 5 cents a day for 6 days. Tomorrow, a new case will hit the headlines. Yet some will remember Jean Dexter. She won't be entirely forgotten. Not entirely. Not altogether. Million stories in the naked city. This has been one of them.
It's not a great movie. I don't even know if it's a great Jules Dassin movie, who made some wonderful films like Brute Force, Thieves Highway, Rafifi. But it's a great New York movie because the city is there in all its glory, and you really get a feel for the city in 1948. You know, the way the cops worked, the way people commuted on the subways. You go in the subways, there, you know, you go in the elevated trains, you go to a bunch of different boroughs, you go from the Lower East Side all the way to Park Avenue, where one of the suspects lives. There's kids, you watch kids swimming in the East River. You really get a sense that you are traveling through this place that really existed and getting these little glimpses into different lives. And it has almost a documentary feel to it. So that's what I really like about it. And it is. It's the naked city. You really feel like you're getting this unvarnished view of New York City at the time, which I really like. I've seen it a few times. It's another one that I really like. The Naked City, available on Hulu Plus.
Where are you from?
I'm in Williamsburg, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So... Represent.
Represent what?
What? I'm representing Williamsburg, bro. You gotta respect where I come from because I respect where you come from. Come on.
You know where we come from, bro?
We come from the hood.
You're in the demon's house.
I had a great day. I went to the shopping mall.
I feel so good about hanging out with my best friends today.
It's what we deserve. You gotta get this out all right so that people can listen to what they want.
Your listener's choice pick this week was The Comedy, which is available on VOD from Tribeca Films, also on iTunes and Amazon and Vudu. And it's actually opening in theaters soon. It's opening in Los Angeles on November 9th. and in New York on November 16th and kind of slowly making its way into different cities from there. Now, the comedy is directed by Rick Alverson, who's directed two indie films before this, The Builder and New Jerusalem, neither of which I'm familiar with. Are you, Matt?
This is the first film of his I've seen.
Yeah, for most, seeing the comedy based on any name recognition, it'll be because of its star, Tim Heidecker, of Tim and Eric. Tim and Eric, awesome show, great job, and so on. Heidecker's frequent collaborator, Eric Wareheim, also appears in the film, as does comedian Greg Turkington and James Murphy of the former band LCD Sound System. The film is a character study of Swanson, played by Heidecker, who is a 35-year-old man who lives on a yacht and spends his days getting trashed with his friends, messing with people, and taking up odd jobs like dishwashing that he doesn't need for financial reasons, as he's due to inherit money from his wealthy father, who's comatose and under a nurse's care. Now, Swanson and his friends, who include Wareheim and Murphy, spend a lot of time drinking and indulging in these kind of half-jokey bull sessions in which they never seem to say anything they actually mean or anything that's not sarcastic, which is how Swanson leads his life overall, when he's not riffing on how people gave up feudalism too soon, or about hobos, or about whether his sister-in-law gets conjugal visits with his brother, who's in a mental institution. He's more aggressively messing with people. He does things like join gardeners working in a lawn and pretends to be their boss. He goes to a bar in which all the patrons are African-American and tosses these half-inflammatory conversational gambits their way. He offers a cab driver hundreds of dollars for a chance to drive his cab for 20 minutes. This is a film about aggressively not caring, about irony as this lifestyle choice and as a shield against ever showing how you really feel. And there are really only a few moments in which we see Swanson do something unguarded, and they're not usually meant for external consumption. So, Matt, my question for you is, this is a portrait of a generally unpleasant person. Did you find the movie an unpleasant experience in terms of watching it?
I didn't find the movie unpleasant. I didn't find it all that compelling, though, either. I felt like, you know, it was tempting to be this sort of deep portrait of shallowness, in a sense. And I don't know if it really got there. And I got the sense about a half hour in, like I felt, whether I was wrong or right, that I knew everything that I was going to learn from this movie, that I got it already. And I was waiting for something for that next hour to change my mind. And it really didn't. I kind of felt like a half hour in, I got a sense of who this guy was and the point that the movie was making about all those things you were talking about. And then I didn't really feel it, like it doesn't have another gear. You know, it never kicks into another gear. Nothing really happens to this guy. This movie didn't quite have enough in there to really justify its length. It felt like a great short film that had been pulled like taffy to 90 minutes. Let's talk about, like, very briefly, The Landlord, that movie I talked about earlier. Here's the comparison. The characters are almost identical in terms of, like, their upbringings and sort of their attitudes. Swanson is much more snarky and cynical, but they have this sort of, like, removed kind of above-it-all sort of attitude. Well, okay, now in The Landlord, that character, something happens to him that we actually get to see him at least, if not change his values, then confront his values and think about them. And I just felt like in the comedy, I was just seeing someone's values kind of expressed over and over again with very little variation. And so I guess that's what I was kind of hoping for. Maybe it's the fact that this movie was watched by me 4 days after this incredible apocalyptic hurricane. And it felt like I was going, what would this guy have done in the middle of Hurricane Sandy? And wouldn't that have been a little more interesting than what happens to him in this movie, which ostensibly is nothing?
Yeah, I think I liked it a little more than you, but I would agree that the fact that this is a static portrait, like he does not give any sense of having grown or changed at the end, like that it is just a portrait of someone and not necessarily a pivotal moment in their life. I think that is disappointing because it does seem like the film just goes on and then ends. And there is a little bit of a sense of repetition in that every sequence, as much as I think a lot of them are kind of like very well done in terms of making you uncomfortable, that they are repetitious in that they don't achieve something new,
right,
as they go along. I'm not sure that you are necessarily supposed to be invested in him as a person. Like, he is, like, you understand him, but that I don't think that
in the end, you care if he lives or dies. And mm-hmm. I don't think that's a question of likability. I think it's just a question of he's a jerk. You know, like this is a portrait of someone who's a jerk, and that you appreciate why that is, and this kind of aimless life he's chosen for himself. But
One thing I wasn't sure about is, are we supposed to despise him or are we supposed to feel empathy for him? The movie seems to want us to do both. I think it's trying to walk a line where we want to sort of, you know, indict him for his behavior, but also in a sense feel sort of like a kind of wistful sadness for this generation. You know, there's a sense of almost like this generation that's aloof and wandering, and that they're, you know, it's like a tragedy almost.
Well, see, I don't know. One of the things I thought was actually very interesting about the movie is that I felt like it was, in terms of portraits of like hipsterdom, for lack of a better term, and that it is very much what this is about, like just in terms of it's set in Williamsburg, which is, you know, one of the capitals of this kind of culture, at least was. A lot of the things they do are exactly from like the PBR drinking or the Colt 45 drinking to like the playing
their clothes,
softball, to their clothes, to the Ray-Bans, and like, you know, the like everything about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it is a little bit of a, I think, a kind of older, like a snapshot of hipsterdom as it was.
Right.
You know, I mean, beyond just the fact that like, if you go to live in Williamsburg these days, you have to have money because it's not the place you would go when you're a 24-year-old, you know, moving to New York anymore. That you'd move a lot further out. But I think that also just the cynicism and the kind of irony is a little bit older, too.
Right. Well, the fact that the characters are older, you know, the guy, they all look to be guys in their mid to late 30s or maybe even a little older than that, which I think also is where the sort of sense of tragicness is maybe supposed to come from, is the fact that these losers are now getting to the point where it's not cool to do this anymore. And it's like, what are they going to do with their lives in 10 years when they're 40 to 50 and they have no jobs and no skills and they're just sitting around watching slideshows and making ridiculous jokes? You lived in Williamsburg at one point in your life, did you not?
Yes, and I live in Greenpoint now, which is kind of glommed into Williamsburg most of the time.
Yeah. So that's one question I had for you, because I mean, obviously I've spent time in Williamsburg, but I never lived there. Did you feel it was an accurate portrait? I think you touched on the outfits, the dress, the look is accurate. Did you feel like these characters, would you have walked into a bar and met these guys? Have you met guys like Swanson in bars?
I've definitely met aging hipsters before.
Okay.
And I think that it is a type. I think that the kind of all-consuming, like, kind of irony, the way that irony, I mean, this is a movie about irony as this almost crippling force, you know, that like, this is a character who might not even know how to sincerely express himself, even if he weren't always goading people and kind of testing them. He's clearly not comfortable saying how he really feels at all. You know, I'm not sure that I can really place that. It's obviously an extreme version anyway, but I'm not sure that I can necessarily relate, especially since now I think that hipster culture has kind of gone in the other direction of like an almost overwhelming twee sincerity, you know, that which is just something I thought was interesting about this, is that this does seem a snapshot of an earlier PBR drinking, trucker hat wearing moment.
Well, that would make sense with these guys who are a little bit older, though, you know, like they've never grown out of it. I will say, just at times, I felt like I wasn't sure that this was the most faithful representation, specifically in the way that the characters talk. When these guys are sitting around having these outrageous, confrontational, kind of very sarcastic, ironic conversations, the only times I've ever heard people actually talk like this for prolonged periods of times were in improv classes. Mm-hmm. You know, they have these, like, there was a sense I got sometimes that there was no script and they were just like, well, what can we say that's outrageous and go on some sort of like comedy run? I'm not saying these guys are bad at it. I'm just saying like that's the atmosphere that I felt in some of these scenes, like people trying to out improv each other, trying to do that and not necessarily have a genuine conversation. Now, maybe the point of the movie is that these men are incapable of having genuine conversations. I could accept that argument. I don't know if that argument makes me like the movie any more than I did.
Right. And it's interesting that also, especially when, well, not even only when Swanson is by himself, but like the kind of terror he inflicts on other people are usually with people, like not other fellow hipsters. They are with the gardener, with the nurse, you know, with the taxi driver whose radio doesn't work. And with people who are basically in service positions, who are not in a place to fight back, which I think is, you know, probably one of the most dislikable things that he does, which is that, like, he constantly messes, like, kind of jokes with people who are not in a position to joke, who actually, you know.
Right.
And I think that that aspect, I don't think is necessarily something that I would ascribe to Williamsburg culture in particular, but I think that maybe it's more telling in a way. Like, I felt like this was, I mean, it's certainly a portrait of self-loathing. You know, there's one part in the film where he's kind of joking and talking to a girl at a party, and he says he thinks that there are some people whose lives are better because they deserve it. They are genetically chosen to be at the top of the food chain. And he's kind of, he's being sort of ironic, but he's also, like, he is been chosen to be at the top of a certain food chain, right? He's been born into this comfortable life. And, you know, he does so many things that are deliberately meant to be grotesque, from even just, like, the way Heidegger uses his body, you know, like, you have all, this is a movie filled with scenes of, like, middle-aged bellies, you know, of, like, men in cutoffs, middle-aged men in cutoffs, basically,
and no
shirt. Almost, and kind of, like, with pot bellies, deliberately, like sitting in the most, like,
bending
unflattering
over,
angle.
Bending over and exposing their bellies.
You know, like, this is a, like, it's a film so filled with self-loathing. In a lot of ways, I felt like so many of these scenes were about him looking to get punched in the face. Like, that all this character wanted was for someone to just deck him.
To call him on his nonsense. Maybe.
But while, of course, always picking on people who are not in a position to really do that.
And not to spoil it, but it never really happens. So it's not like that is a, you know, it's not like there's a place for that to go within the movie, because it's this constant search for him to be called on his nonsense, and it never happens. He goes around, I thought it was kind of interesting how he does go around trying on jobs, because he doesn't
work working class jobs, you know, like very
lawn
deliberately
work,
menial
bartending, dishwashing, you know, and he's almost like working in a sarcasm, he turns work into sarcasm, like he goes to a, he gets a dishwashing job, and then he stands there and brushes his teeth at the dishwashing job waiting for someone to, like, look at him. I thought that was kind of interesting. I also thought it was sort of interesting to look at the movie almost as, like, Tim and Eric's, like, Stardust memories, because I felt, in a sense, like this was their audience, right? I mean, these sorts of guys are the people that really dig their TV show, their movies. You know, like, that sort of detached, ironic hipster is sort of exactly who they're catering their TV show to. I mean, there's not too many people beyond that that like their shows.
That's an interesting point. I was going to ask you, actually, how you thought this fit in with the brand of anti-comedy that they really practice, because it does seem like it's related, but almost a condemnation of it. You know, in
That's what I'm saying. Like, it really, I mean, certainly, like you said, I felt self-loathing was a word I had in my notes. It definitely feels like they are sort of looking at themselves or at their audience potentially and sort of pointing a finger and saying, why are you, or maybe why are we this way? But it's sort of biting the hand that feeds them, because this is the, who else is going to watch Tim and Eric's show? I mean, not too many people beyond, I mean, like, I have to imagine the Williamsburg kind of is like a huge concentration of the people that have actually watched their show. I mean, I think they're talented guys, but if we went to a state in the middle of the country and just walked into a mall and asked 50 people who are Tim and Eric, I don't know how many people would know. If we walked into the, you know, a bar in Williamsburg, they would all know.
They would all know,
So it's interesting that the movie that I thought of was Stardust Memories, that I felt like this was sort of them kind of really taking a very hard look at themselves and at their audience and going, why is my audience, why does my audience like my work? And is that a good thing? Am I appealing to an audience that I don't like, potentially, which is always interesting. And like I said, I thought there was interesting things in the movie. I just thought they were all of sort of a piece. You know, there was just all one level there, and I never felt like we got anywhere else. We never went below it. And I just, at a certain point, I was just like, well, what else is there? What else is there to, okay, I understand what you're doing.
Right.
What's next? And there was nothing next.
What did you think of his character's relationship with the waitress he kind of picks up at his dishwashing job? I mean, there's a scene in it. I don't think this is a spoiler. She has a seizure, and he just watches her.
Right.
And has, like, no particular alarm on his face or surprise or concern. What did you make of that?
I just thought it was another case of his complete detachment from everything and everyone around him. I mean, isn't that what he is? He's above everything, you know? He's looking down on everyone and everything. And you talked earlier about that quote that he says about how some people are genetically, you know, predisposed to be superior or whatever. And to me, that was what was going through his mind. It's like, oh, she's, you know, she's another person who's damaged, who is not up to the level of Swanson.
That's interesting. See, when I was watching it, what I thought was maybe that he also, because this is a girl who kind of talks the same way he does, you know, who is just as kind of like,
she seems to enjoy that
jokey,
same,
yeah, that he was so unsure if she was just messing with him that he did not react because he would, he didn't want to like prove that he
cared,
that cared or just had any genuine reaction.
Interesting.
So he instead chose to kind of like just look there in case she was joking. She'd be like, I got you.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask you this last question. Which do you prefer? Because we did, this is the second Tim Heidecker film that we have covered on this podcast in only 20 episodes. Do you prefer Tim and Eric's Billion Dollar Movie or the comedy?
The comedy by far.
I see. I think I would rather watch Tim and Eric's Billion Dollar Movie again.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Either way, I feel like maybe we have a lot to say about their films, but I don't know that I would really consider myself a great devotee of either of them.
Agreed.
The comedy is currently available on VOD. It's also available for rent on iTunes and Vudu and Amazon, and will be in theaters shortly.
All right, we close out the show with Behind the Eight Ball, our countdown of three new releases, two expiring titles, and one random film from our queue. Allison's going to go first. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right, well, let's start things off with three new releases.
All right, the first one is 24/7, 1997 film that is new on Hulu. This is one of the early films from Shane Meadows, who is a very promising indie English director who did Dead Man's Shoes, This Is England, and Summer's Town. It's actually his second feature. It stars Bob Hoskins as a man from a working class town who opens up a boxing center to train and also give something to do for the young men who otherwise end up in trouble. So that is 24/7. It is on Hulu. Next is Out of Sight, Steven Soderbergh's 1998 film, which is new to Netflix, stars George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez, and is one of the films that I think makes me think that maybe I like Soderbergh's commercial efforts more than I like his more heady experiments. I just think he's so good at directing stars. I think this is one of those films that makes you really appreciate the kind of amazing star qualities and charisma of Clooney and Lopez, who are just great together. That is Out of Sight. It is new to Netflix. And finally, also new to Netflix, Barton Fink, 1991 film from the Coen brothers, starring John Turturro as a promising New York City playwright who, like so many promising people from kind of different fields, ended up in Hollywood not doing the type of work he really wanted to do. And this is one of my favorite Coen brothers films, and it's such a great surreal portrait of a Hollywood as hell, basically. And especially good John Goodman as Charlie, who lives in the same hotel as Turturro's character. So that is Barton Fink, and it is on Netflix.
Okay, two expiring titles.
Right. Expiring on November 9th from Netflix is Lovely Still. This is a later in life romance about how a man named Robert, played by Martin Landau, falls in love with Mary, who is played by Ellen Burstyn, who is the mother of his neighbor. This is a love story with a major twist that I won't give away, but it is not quite as straightforward as I've just made it sound. So it's got a kind of interesting take.
Is one of them dead all along?
They're both dead all along.
Whoa.
Everyone is dead. I know. All right. And then expiring on November 15th is Everyone Else, which is the great film from Maren Otte, the German director, a 2009 film about a couple who are on vacation, who are confronting issues about their future. They're in Sardinia. They get along really well when they're just together, but have a lot of trouble that comes to light when they're in the company of others. And, Ada is one of the filmmakers that's from this movement that's supposed to be a European successor to Mumblecore in certain ways. That sounds scary. This is a great film with two very good performances and a very nuanced portrait of kind of the problems a couple can have. So that's Everyone Else. It is expiring from Netflix November 15th.
Okay, and one random film from your queue.
All right. So you gave me number 101, and that is W.E., the 2001 film directed by Madonna.
Nice.
Yes, starring Abbie Cornish as a New York woman in 1998, obsessed with American socialite Wallace Simpson.
I smell a listener's choice movie coming up real
played
soon.
By Andrea Riseborough, mm-hmm. And it intertwines the story of how King Edward VIII, played by James Darcy, fell in love with her, abdicated the throne for her, Et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. I've heard this film is outrageously awful in some ways, which is part of the reason that I added this, as well as, you know, how can I resist seeing what comes from the mind of Madonna?
Hmm.
All right. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's go. Let's do it.
Three new films.
Okay. First up on Netflix is a film entitled The American Scream. It is a documentary about home haunters. It's from the director of the documentary Best Worst Movie, which was about Troll 2. I just watched it myself earlier this week. It's a really, really lovely little documentary about people who are just – they're just passionate about Halloween, and they this is their expression. This is their art, is changing their house into a haunted house for Halloween. It's a really fun documentary. Even though it's not Halloween anymore, I think you'll still enjoy it. Also on Netflix is Thieves Like Us, the 1974 Robert Altman film with Keith Carradine and Shelley Duvall as thieves in the Great Depression. This is actually an Altman I've never seen. So this is one I'm really looking forward to catching up with myself. And last, I've got Red Scorpion, also on Netflix. This is a 1989 Dolph Lundgren action movie, notable in one important way. It was produced by Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist who ended up going to jail for fraud and tax evasion. He was a huge public figure a few years ago for that scandal. The film is a very thinly veiled, I've watched it, it's a very thinly veiled pro-Republican, anti-communist tract in the form of a Dolph Lundgren movie. Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. So that's Red Scorpion on Netflix.
Okay, two expiring titles.
Both of these films are expiring on November 15th from Netflix. First up, I have Assault on Precinct 13, the John Carpenter thriller set in a police station under siege. Kind of a very loose update of Rio Bravo, the Western. Tense, gritty, very exciting. Another film in which the remake never happened, Allison.
What remake?
Exactly. Also expiring on November 15th, Sherlock Jr., the Buster Keaton classic, where he plays a movie theater projectionist who falls asleep and dreams himself into the movies. One of my all-time favorite silent movies, one of my favorite Buster Keaton movies. If you've never seen it, it is just delightful. And if you've ever heard the stories about Buster Keaton, this is the one where, doing a stunt, he actually broke his neck and didn't even realize it and just kept on filming. He said years later he was checked out and a doctor found the fracture and saw that it had healed on its own. He's like, oh yeah, I think I had a couple of headaches a few days after that. So that's Sherlock Jr. From Psycho Buster Keaton, expiring on November 15th.
Okay, and one from your queue.
You gave me number 80, which is not a movie this week. That's a TV show. It is Saturday Night Live, the 1970s. I just have all the Saturday Night Lives on there sometimes when I'm scrounging for something non-movie related to watch. I put on Saturday Night Live because I really love the show. I'm fascinated by the show and the whole history of it and all the different casts and the up and downs of the show. I'll give you one episode recommendation from the 70s. Season 4, episode 20, Buck Henry hosts. There's a Samurai Bakery sketch and a very good Olympia Cafe sketch. You know the Olympia Cafe?
Of course.
Cheeseburger?
Of course.
Yeah, so that's Saturday Night Live, colon, the 1970s.
Okay, here are your picks for our next episode's Listener's Choice, in which you get to vote on what we will review next. What's our first pick?
Our first pick is, I know, Allison's favorite movie of 2012 so far. It is entitled Lockout, or more accurately entitled Space Jail, the 2012 film directed by James Mather and Stephen St. Leger. It stars Guy Pearce as, do you remember his character name?
Marion Snow.
That's right. And he is sent to a place in space called Space Jail, where there are people in jail, and it's in space.
Yeah.
And it's a powerful film of love and loss and redemption.
And it's now been proven very scientifically accurate.
That's right.
By the recent Red Bull space jump.
That's right. So Allison and I enjoyed this film when it came out. Apparently we want to see it again because we're making it an option for Listener's Choice. So that is Lockout. It will be available on Netflix, even if we don't review it. It will be available on Netflix starting on November 7th.
Okay, our next pick is Bottle Rocket. It is available on Crackle. This is Wes Anderson's first film, based on a short film he made in 1992, co-written by and starring Owen Wilson. He plays a character named Dignan, who is best friends with someone named Anthony, played by Luke Wilson. The two try to become criminals, basically. They're not particularly good at it, but they have very Wes Anderson-esque adventures, and we thought it would be interesting to look at this. You've never seen this film, though.
I have never seen Bottle Rocket.
So, you know.
I'm not the biggest Wes Anderson film fan out there, Allison. So this is my chance to antagonize the film-spotting SVU listening public and ensure they never listen again.
So if you want some The Comedy-style goading
That's
from
right.
Matt Singer
That's
about
right.
the career of you know, all of the people involved in making this, then this is your pick.
Conversely, if you're such a huge Wes Anderson fan that you don't want to hear me destroy the man, then don't vote for it.
All right. Why don't you tell us our next pick?
Our last pick this week is Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, which is recently added to Hulu Plus in the Criterion Collection section. And of all the kind of great international film directors, I would say the one of mine who I have seen the least of, as in I have seen nothing he ever did, and so it's a huge blind spot for me, is Rainer Werner Fassbinder. I've seen nothing by Fassbinder. So for me, that's the big reason to see this one. I don't really know too much about it. I know it's considered one of his greatest films, and it was just added to Hulu. So I thought that would be a good reason to see it. Allison, have you seen this movie?
I have not seen it.
Have you seen any Fassbender movies?
I don't know that I have. So he's also a huge blind spot for
me. It's that's an embarrassing one. Like, you know, you name a great director, I'm not going to pretend like I've seen all of his movies, but he or she, I've seen at least one, probably.
Yeah. So,
and I have seen no Fassbender movies.
So you could save us from our ignorance by picking this one.
That's right.
All right. So which movie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can also enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, November 12th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, which is at filmspottingsvu, and you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on the next week's episode, which will be on Monday, November 19th, give or take a day.
Film Spotting SVU is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick. In the meantime, you can follow me and Allison on Twitter, at Allison Wilmore or at Matt Singer. And you can follow the show, of course, at Film Spotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, and we share more streaming suggestions from you guys, the SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.